Psalm 19. To the choir master, a psalm of David. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words, whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and like a strong man runs its course with joy. Its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit to the end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The rules of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, even much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and drippings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is your servant warned. In keeping them, there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Declare me innocent from hidden faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless and innocent of great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Amen. You probably don't think of the Psalms as being episodes in some sort of mini-series, but sometimes they work that way. And in particular, Psalm 18 left us hanging with David saying that he was going to sing praise to the Lord among the nations. And then the psalm ended. And we're left wondering, what is it that David is going to sing? What is he going around the nations putting to music? Well, Bible maths, there's a reason why Psalm 19 comes right after the end of Psalm 18. And David gives us some pretty big clues that he's put the two of them together as a pair to tell a story between them. So, for example, and it might help you if you've got Psalm 19 open so that you can flick back to 18, the two psalms have bookends that bind them together on the outside. So if you follow me to the beginning of Psalm 18 and verse 2, do you see there, the Lord, so his name, is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. My God, my rock, in whom I take refuge, my shield, and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. And then in verse 31 of 18, you get again that idea of the Lord's name and a rock. So, verse 31, for who is God but the Lord? And who is a rock except our God? And then in verse 46, you again have that triplet of the Lord's covenant name being my rock and my salvation. Do you see it there? The Lord lives, and blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of my salvation. Do you see those three things? The Lord's name, my rock, and my salvation. Now flick with me to the very end of Psalm 19. That last line there, O Lord, his covenant name, my rock, once again, and my Redeemer. That's the outer edges. Those are the ends binding it together as one book. But there's also a glue binding the two psalms together into one volume. So have a look with me at the title of Psalm 19. So we've got there to the choir master, and then a psalm of David. Now that's not at all unusual. But what is unusual is that right before that, we've had David at the end of Psalm 18 mentioned by name, not in a title, but in the psalm. So, okay, nothing too excited about. But that other word in the title, a psalm of David. What is a psalm? What does it mean? A psalm meant either, so to psalm meant either to sing praises or to play a stringed instrument, say a ukulele or a lute or a harp, or especially to sing praises to the tune of a stringed instrument, like, let's say, a harp. Again, it's quite a common word, but right there at the end of Psalm 18, David says in verse 49, "For this I will psalm you." It's the same word, "O Lord among the nations, and sing to your name. Great salvation he brings to his king, and shows steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his offspring forever." So here we have David mentioned, reminding us that he is the one who's going to go and sing a psalm among the nations, and the next thing we have is a psalm of David. So nothing spectacular, but quite a clue as you get to the end of the one psalm and then hit the beginning of the next one, to maybe suggest that what we've got here in Psalm 19 is what David was going to go and sing among the nations. Because you see, where was he going to sing it? Verse 49, "For this I will praise you among the nations." Do you remember how Psalm 18 ended? Some nations had attacked David. He had fended them off. God had saved him, given him victory. And then a whole load of other countries that he'd never heard of get wind of it and come cringing to God's king, wanting to serve him. And so David sees that they want to be saved by his God, and he promises to go and spread his gospel among the nations. And that's what he promises at the end of 18. And so in 19, I think we have the gospel that David is going to proclaim among the nations. So that's the first thing we see in Psalm 19, that David is proclaiming God's salvation to the whole world. And we see that especially in verses 1 to 6. Do you see what the first half of that psalm is all about? It's all about the glory of God being proclaimed throughout the nations, across the whole world. So, for example, verse 4. "Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." Do you see? So when we have the heavens declaring God's glory, the sun running its course, running a circuit around the globe, nobody can hide from the heat of the sun as it does that circuit. Here is David talking about his message about God's salvation, running around the world in the hearing of everybody. That's the scope of David's gospel as he proclaims it, as he tells the whole world that his God rescued him, that David's God had rescued his anointed. And so just as at the end of Psalm 18, after celebrating his victory, he had promised that he was going to tell the whole world about it, about God's salvation, here he is, doing just that, letting his good news of God's rescue run around the globe like the heat of the sun. So do you remember how we began our series? Do you remember how we saw that the Psalms running up to 14 have the whole world, the nations of the world, as being universally ungodly, full of unrighteousness, And we end with that desire at the end of 14, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. And we've been looking at what do we need by way of a saviour who can go up to Zion and bring salvation out. And this week, the thing we learn about him, the thing that fills out the identikit, is that he goes to get salvation out of Zion to then spread it throughout the world of nations. So there can be no hint of favoritism for any nation in our proclamation of the gospel. There can be no exceptional standing for England or for Israel or for Uganda or for the North Pole or for the US or for Spain. David, 1,000 years before Jesus, was already committed to the fact that as the heat of the sun goes everywhere, so does the good news that God saves have to go to every nation so that they will come and worship his Messiah. David is the kind of saved person who knows that salvation isn't there just for me to receive. That salvation and the fact that I have received it is too glorious to keep quiet about. That it's there to be sung about everywhere. There to be spread around. There to be received as far as the sun travels. But we've also seen, as we've been investigating this mystery character of who's going to go and get salvation out of Zion, we've seen in Psalm 15 that he has to be righteous. And we're left with that question hanging. How does he get to be righteous? And in Psalm 16 we saw that he is blessed, utterly certain of blessings. How did he get to be blessed by God? In Psalm 17, we saw that he goes up to get salvation from the midst of trouble, hemmed in on every side. How did he get out of that trouble? And last week, it was as though we'd got the answer. We saw that he was blessed, victorious, rescued out of trouble because of his righteousness, which we already knew about from Psalm 15. Last week we learned again that he had to be righteous so that God would take his side in the trouble. So that God would say, you are the one who is not at fault. These are the ones who are unrighteous against you. I'm taking your side. But what David gives us this week is the answer behind the answer. How is it exactly that David became righteous? He told us all through Psalm 18 that his righteousness meant that God took his side. What did he do to be righteous? And the answer that he gives us in Psalm 19 is very simple and very disarming. Because of God's law. David says that he became righteous because of God's life-giving law. Where did David's righteousness come from? It came from God's commandments. And that's the second thing we see here today. David's message to the nations is that God's law is the source of his victory. And we see that in verses 7 to 11, where we have there what David is proclaiming to the nations. He's telling them, God's law is the source of my righteousness, of my victory. Now, when you read these two psalms together, there's a ton of word plays, and it would be irresponsible for the ESV, for any translation, to try and keep them, because words mean different things in slightly different contexts. But the word pairs are there. The things which the law promises here in Psalm 19, they are the very things that David had told us in Psalm 18 were the sources of his victory. Let me show you a couple of them. Look with me, if you would, in Psalm 19 at verse 7, where we have there that the law of the Lord is perfect,
reviving the soul. That word for revive we saw twice last week in Psalm 18. It's there in verse 20. Psalm 18 and verse 20. The Lord dealt with me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he rewarded, it's the same word as revived, me. And then in verse 24, so the Lord has rewarded. Again, it's the same word that we have in Psalm 19 for revived, according to the cleanness of my hands. So in Psalm 18, he's telling us that God rewarded him with victory, with salvation from his enemies because of his righteousness. And then Psalm 19 tells us, David says that it is the law that revives, that rewards the soul. And in between those two verses, in Psalm 18, we saw last week that there David spells out in detail his own righteousness. And there is a ton of words there that we then find repeated in Psalm 19, specifically as being how David in the law found life and righteousness and reward. So for instance, Psalm 18 tells us that I was perfect before him. But if you return with me to Psalm 19 and verse 7, there we have that the law of the Lord is perfect. In Psalm 18, we had, according to the purity of my hands, he rewarded me. And again, according to the purity of my hands, in his eyes. But in verse 8 of 19, do you see what we have there? The commandment of the Lord is pure. That's where David found purity. And it enlightens the eyes. Or again last week, David said, for all his rules were before me. And in Psalm 19, we have that the rules of the Lord are true. And most basically, David insisted last week, the Lord dealt with me according to my righteousness. He says it twice. So the Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness. Well, where did he find righteousness? Do you see it there in Psalm 19, in verse 9, at the very end? The rules of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. David insisted that he has stuck to the law like glue. He said last week, for I have kept the ways of the Lord, and I kept myself from guilt. And do you see it here in verse 11? By them is your servant warned. In keeping them, that is his law, his commandments, there is great reward. David ends Psalm 19 in verse 13. Do you see it there? By saying, then I shall be blameless. Same word as perfect, which in Psalm 18, David has used over and over, saying that David is perfect, that the Lord is perfect, but especially that it's the Lord who made his way perfect. And now we find out how the Lord did it. How did the Lord make David's way perfect? Through his law, which is perfect, which revives, gives life to the soul, which takes the simple and makes him wise, which takes the downcast heart and gives it joy and makes him the man rejoice, which takes the darkened eyes and enlightens them. This law, David says, these commandments are more to be desired than gold, sweeter than honey. That is how David defeated his enemies. That is how the Lord made him righteous. But did you notice as we read it that David isn't talking about the law in general? David gets down to brass tacks. David gets specific. He's not using blanket terms for everything that God has revealed. He's not just talking about the covenant. No, he's talking about the legal stipulations. He mentions not just the law, but the testimonies, verse 7. The precepts, verse 8. The commandments, specifically in verse 8. The rules, in verse 9. So he doesn't say that in keeping it, there is great reward as a blanket thing. No, in keeping them, the specific details, that is where there is great reward in verse 11. It's not in verse 10 that the law in general is highly desirable, but they, the statutes, are better than gold. They are sweeter than honey. See, he's come back to where he began in Psalm 15. It's the detail, the gritty detail of God's law applied to our lives day by day. That is the measure of our righteousness. That is where David found the power to be rescued by the Lord from the unrighteous nations. It's by not slandering his neighbor. It's by when he makes a business deal, not backing out if the stock market changes. That is how David found the power to be rescued by the Lord from unrighteous, law-breaking nations. And it's important to see that. Why? Because there is a way of thinking about God's law which is simply at odds with what David here and the Bible generally tells us. I'm not the problem. The law is the problem. There's nothing wrong with me, you understand. It's this law that's impossible, too hard for me. Now, what are we doing when we say that the law is too hard? Ironically, we're falling into moralism. When we say that the problem is that the law will only ever condemn me, I'm actually buying into legalism. When I say that the law is something that I cannot possibly keep, I'm engaging in self-righteousness. See, all of these are ways of saying, let me justify myself before you. Let me show you that my works will do. See, to make sense of the gospel, of why Jesus died for us, we have to understand where the problem lies. And the problem is here. The problem is in my heart. The problem is not outside of me, for example, in the law. So the problem is not, to quote Adam, this woman you put here with me. The problem is not, to quote Eve, well, the serpent came and deceived me. The problem is in here and not outside of my chest cavity. The problem is not God's law. The problem is my lack of willingness to keep the law, otherwise known as sin and sinfulness. See, do you remember as we looked through the letter to the Hebrews a year ago, and you get to that point where he tells us that God had to make a new covenant, and you're crying out for him to say, and God found fault with the law, and he doesn't. He says, God found fault with them, with the people, with us. We are the problem. And the solution isn't to blame God's law. The solution is God's Messiah. The solution is Christ. And the way to Christ is to look at the law and not say of it that it is bad and useless and will only kill you. It is to look at the law and notice what David says, that it is good and saving and life-giving and all the things that Psalm 19 says, and that despite all that, we still don't keep it. Only then, only when we see that the law is not the problem, are we ready to accept the one and only solution. Solution to the problem that is in here. We need a righteousness from outside of me to come into me and replace the unrighteousness that is inside of me. A righteousness that can deal with the ability of my own heart to manufacture unrighteousness in just as much detail as the law can prescribe justice. I'm confident that I'm not speaking just for me when I say, I am the problem. The law is not the problem. We are the problem. So, very simple question for all of us. If this is true, if what David says about the goodness of the law in detail is true, if the laws, the statutes, the rules, the testimonies bring such benefit, how familiar are we with them? It's only a month since Craig told us who can ascend the hill of the Lord. Can you remember what the ethical criteria are for ascending the hill of the Lord? Or did you turn that sermon into, that's interesting, something about ethics, okay, move on to the big picture? I've been shocked to find men being interviewed for ordination and being asked, can you put the Ten Commandments in order? And they can't. Do you remember two Thursdays ago, we saw that Luther thought, well, you don't call somebody a Christian if he doesn't know the Ten Commandments, because if somebody who doesn't know that it's not okay to steal, you're going to call that a follower of Jesus? David is serious when he commends to us the law and what it does for us. But David's trust is not ever in the law, highly though he commends it. Do you notice that he ends the psalm by praying for God himself to preserve him? He doesn't pray for the law to preserve him. He knows that, for example, in verse 11, the law will warn him. But it will not, it cannot keep him. The law itself has no power, despite being as good as David says. It is God who is the power behind the law. That is true of all of God's word. Why is it powerful? Why is it living and active? Why is the gospel the power for salvation? Because it's the power of God for salvation. Why is the law life-giving, as David says? Because God is the life-giver. And that is why we have here a psalm of David and not a psalm of Jesus. Because he's praying from within a thorough awareness of his own sin. See, we've said before, haven't we, that having King David write for us does two things. As King of Israel, he's our model believer to follow. And as God's anointed King of Israel, he is the ancestor of that greatest of kings, that Messiah who went up the holy hill to get salvation for us. And he is the one who, without qualification, can say the first 10 verses of this psalm. Jesus is the one who can look at God's law and say, all I get from it is wisdom and delight, and it tastes like honey, and it's worth more than gold. He kept it perfectly. But Jesus couldn't really say, verse 12, who can discern his errors? Meaning himself, he had no errors. Declare me innocent from hidden faults. What faults? And what was hidden from Jesus? Keep back your servant from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. That's not the voice of the Master. That is a sinful, saved person. We see once again that David is well aware of his own sinfulness. It's not a hint of self-justification, of moralism, of self-righteousness in this psalm. This psalm comes from the same pen that gave us Psalm 51, that broken man knowing that he is sinful from the moment his mother conceived him. Here is a sinful man who knows that he is in relationship with the Lord who has saved him. And he knows that he is at one and the same time guilty before him, and by himself worthy of nothing but death, and that God has saved him because of the free grace of God's love in the gospel. And yet at the same time, he knows that God does care how he lives. He knows that God is not indifferent to his day-to-day obedience to God, that God treats his imperfect obedience as significant. David looks at his success against the nations and asks himself, why me and not them? And at one and the same time knows, because God chose me and has given his salvation to me despite my sins. And yet also, he knows that the only way that he has pleased the Lord is by obeying him, by his obedience to him. With a perfect obedience? No. With an obedience mingled with sin? Yes. But the obedience of one in a saving relationship with the Lord. It was a righteousness as stipulated by the one who is in a saving relationship with him. So it seems to me we mustn't ever think of the law or present the law as a sort of exam syllabus, as though God sets that up for you and says, on some day you don't know, I'll come back and judge you, and you'll sit that exam and we'll see how you did. No, God gives himself to us. He puts himself, because of his grace, in a relationship with us. He saves us, and within that relationship, shows us how to live, shows us the way of blessing, shows us the way of righteousness, having been saved. And that's why David can end, as we will end now, by praying. Verse 14. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer.